75 and 9, the awesome Wendy's in their prime, the bowl is quick, the batsman fine. Remember? Do you remember? Nope, I can't remember, that was too long ago. Yeah. Holding Marshall, Garner, Lloyd, and Mighty Bid. Mighty Bid. They were going for the hat trick, the greatest team that lived, that lived. They swagger, then they stagger out, they shake their heads, they cry. How on earth did we lose to a team that played Yash Pal at five?
Who let the underdogs out? What's happening all of a sudden to the World Cup? One day Sri Lanka thump England, the next evening Afghanistan are within touching distance of upsetting India. And as of that evening needed more drama, Carlos Brathwaite did his thing in Old Trafford, making it his own theatre of dreams until, as Ian Bishop put it so perfectly again, the dream was diminished for him and the West Indies. And as we speak, Pakistan are sort of cruising their way to victory. Who knows how laughable that might sound in a few hours or when you get to listen to this. On that note, it's time to welcome two of our writers, two of our finest writers, it must be said, who've been in the thick of all the action. Andrew Fidel Fernando, who by this point is a regular on this podcast. Hey, Fidel, welcome back.
Srinath, hi, how are you doing?
Doing great. You've just reached London and you're heading back to the north. Someone who's just come back from the north to London for the first time, host of our English cricket podcast, Switch Hit, and another of our funny men, Alan Gardner, making time in the middle of a busy day at home. Hey, Alan.
Hey, how's it going?
All good. We have a panel then. Let's begin. There's only one place to start, Alan. Fidel's already given up on making sense of that Sri Lankan win, and I don't blame him. If you got anything more than a resigned sense of shock and awe at the whole thing, you were at the ground. You were witness to probably the result of the tournament so far. Are we just dismissing this as a regular big tournament banana peel for England?
Well, I suppose, yeah, for old England, that would be very much the case. For this new confident white ball dominating team, this was a bit more sort of bizarro world, really, sort of stepping into a parallel dimension for a little while. I suppose Yorkshire is a separate country, so maybe that was part of the problem. But
you had some fans, didn't you, saying that they're supporting Sri Lanka?
English well, exactly. Fans. I mean. That was quite a nice little story, actually, with a random couple that I spotted wearing Sri Lanka shirts, and the guy was saying how he spent several years helping to build homes in Sri Lanka after the tsunami. So he was supporting, him and his wife were supporting Sri Lanka that day. They said they'd cheer the Yorkshire players for England. And there is obviously famously a kind of a bit of a them and us mentality. People of Yorkshire sometimes preferring to support the players of Yorkshire and the cricket team of Yorkshire rather than the cricket team of England. But I mean, I don't think we can really blame that for what happened on Friday. It was sensational. I suppose it was built on two old school performances from a couple of old school players, Angelo Matthews and Latif Malinga. And England, not for the first time in the tournament, of course, Pakistan at Trent Bridge a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, England kind of misread the script again and wobbled off to a defeat, which could make the tournament interesting at the very least.
So there are lots of things to unpack there. The one question on all our minds, which you answered, I think we've spoken about it earlier as well. A Sri Lankan win that is not built on the back of a great spin bowling performance, in the sense not by a frontline spinner. You had alerted us about Dhananjaya da Silva long ago, and he was the one to deliver the game-changing overs in the end. How was he rated by the team management first up, and was it not a surprise at all to you that he delivered in a game like this?
No, it wasn't a surprise because we've seen him. So Dhananjaya da Silva is one of these crazy stories that can only really happen in Sri Lankan cricket, right? Like, he came on the scene and he was, in 2016, he had this amazing first test series against Australia. I think it's against Stark, Hazelwood, Lyon. His first scoring shot in a test was a six. Like, he just had an absolutely rocking series with the bat. And then he just got... He got like kicked around the top order a lot. You know, some series he was batting three, some he was opening, some he was back down at six and seven, some he was at five. So no one ever really knew what his role was, and he was always the guy making room for other people. And you kind of felt sorry for him a bit that he was being treated like this. And it hasn't allowed him to solidify a role in the side. And full credit to him, he keeps making a case for getting picked, because he's just gone away and said, if I'm not getting picked for my batting, I'm going to work on my bowling. And he was probably a little bit better than a part-timer, but no, I wouldn't have called him an all-rounder back in 2016 when he turned up. Now he's the best spin option that Sri Lanka have, not because he turns the ball or does anything extraordinary, but just because he's just a very smart bowler, especially he's one who's very hard to attack consistently. If a player starts going after him, generally Dhananjay does something unexpected and either gets the wicket or keeps him quiet. And he varies up his flight and his pace really well. And that's really the key to him. And that's something that that can take players quite a long way in cricket. I mean, Ranganahera built a career out of that. So he's very much in that. He's not a big turner of the ball. He's not going to turn it in a different direction than you expect. He's got two variations, essentially. But he's very smart. He knows how to make decisions. He's never flustered with the bat or the ball. He's very calm, sort of relaxed guy. And those are his strengths. And I wasn't surprised, no, because he also swung a match in Port Elizabeth earlier this year, a test match. Sri Lanka came from behind thanks to his day two spell and were able to get into a position of strength and eventually win that test match in quite unexpected and sensational fashion. So, no, we've seen him do it before, so I wasn't surprised. And I think team management now have wisened up to the fact that he is the best spin option. So we'll see a lot more of him, I'm sure, towards the other three games that Sri Lanka have remaining this tournament.
I'm going to make you say the exact same words again later on this podcast about another pretty much similar cricketer in Mohammad Nabi, whom you've written about. Spinner who doesn't do anything extraordinary but delivers and is very hard to kind of get away with, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Nabi's even more, I think, you know, if you're comparing Dhananjay to Nabi, Dhananjay is a very stylish player, like, you know, especially with the bat. He has like a beautiful on drive. He's got, his pull is a thing of beauty, but Nabi is completely nondescript, batting and bowling. It's just like he's put all of his point. If you think about Nabi in a video game, he's put all of his points towards just being effective and none on style or aesthetics. He just does what needs to be done. And yesterday was a perfect case of that. He didn't look like he was doing anything exciting. He got Virat Kohli with one that he just teased him with outside, wide outside the line, got it to bounce a little bit more, got Virat Kohli's wicket. And Kohli was the only batsman who looked like he had the measure of that pitch. He was batting in a completely different way from everyone else. And he looked set for 100. I mean, it looked destined that he was there for 100. But Nabi managed to get him out. And then with the bat, he was just as good. I mean, wickets were falling around him. He was facing down some very, very high quality bowling from India. And yet he just kept hitting those singles, kept hitting the fours at the right time. I thought that Afghanistan were never quite on top of that chase. They never got to a stage where they were ahead, I thought, because, when you have the likes of Bumrah, they had four overs of Bumrah to face at the end. I always thought India would, that was the ace that India had and, that they would be able to come back and keep Afghanistan quiet in those final overs. But Nabi, that wasn't Nabi's fault. He should have had a little bit more support from maybe Najibul Dasadran. The way Hazratullah got out earlier in the match was pretty terrible. So it was more a case of his teammates letting him down a bit.
Just before we head completely away to the India-Afghanistan game, Alan, just coming back to you, you did write about Lasith Malinga. The one interesting thing that happened in the aftermath of the game was Mahela Jayawardena sharing a picture of Malinga from the footage where he's half naked till his torso and his paunch is showing and he's kind of making fun of a guy who's got all these issues. But at the end of the day, is the strike bowler, is the match winner, remains the go-to guy for the captain. What was it like watching him at the ground? And, he's kind of given a rallying call at the beginning of the tournament in Sinhala, which kind of became a very popular video in terms of what he wanted his teammates to do to kind of feel ashamed about losing, etc. Did it kind of feel like he was carrying the team through that chase? Because 232 is a total England probably chase blindfolded these days.
Yeah, we touched on Afghanistan there. Of course, the difference with this performance, the Sri Lanka performance, was that they won hearts, minds and the match. So good on them for that. Malinga, yeah, it was kind of extraordinary. And I suppose, the picture is a great one. I kind of admire a sportsman who can kind of get to that level with his game, and also sport a gut on which you could easily balance a pint. So, I mean, forget strength and conditioning. Yeah, this was an all round athlete, shall we say? And then, I mean, he's flown back to Sri Lanka twice in the past fortnight. I mean, that's another crazy aspect of this. His mother-in-law, I think, passed away, and he went back for the funeral, and then came and played against Australia, and then went back for almsgiving, I think, and then came back again. And Sri Lanka said, "Look, well, you can have the game off if you want. Clearly, you're not, peak physical condition these days, but." There was none of it, and we saw him sort of kind of bowling a little bit in the middle on the eve of the game, and just sort of running through those old routines. I mean, he is a bit like a tribute act, I suppose, these days. He's several miles an hour slower. He's a bit wider. He's a bit more air in the tire around the waist, as we've discussed. But he's still got that magnetic quality and that ability to bowl a slow dipping Yorker. I mean, I suppose I didn't think about it much at the time, but the kind of the ball that won Mumbai Indians the IPL a couple of months ago, he rolled that out again twice to good effect. Exactly. I mean, the four batsmen he got out, I mean, the two openers, I mean, James Ince is a bit of a gimme, but Bairstow, Root when set, albeit, you know, a strangle down the leg side, and then Butler just before he could get going, and you know, Butler had batted for 5-10 overs, then that might have been the difference in the chase. But yeah, there was something about Malinga. Obviously, he struck with his second ball. He these days he looks almost like every delivery is going to be a dipping Yorker. But they're not, you know, there are bouncers, there's good length stuff. I mean, he sucked in Vince with a nicely pitched up ball. And that he just created something which the team could, I don't know, coalesce around, could unite around. There was good energy actually in the field from Sri Lanka early on. I noticed there were a lot of the players were well inside the ring. You know, they were really keen to cut down angles, cut off singles, put pressure on England early. Obviously helped that Malinga got that wicket with his second ball, Bairstow gone. England didn't get a good start. And albeit that Root was going nicely, the chase wasn't, you know, getting away from Sri Lanka either. And then, you know, that second spell when Malinga came back and got Root and Butler cracked it open. And having sort of given his teammates that tongue lashing earlier in the tournament and then helped them to beat Afghanistan, albeit, you know, you'd expect them to beat Afghanistan, but that was a tricky game as well. Yeah, it does seem as if, you know, he's kind of just rolling out some of the old hits at the World Cup. You know, it's so many great days at World Cups for Lasith Malinga, and Friday was another one.
The 126 over, which Alan's talking about, when England were 126 and Root and Butler were batting Fidel, that kind of was a throwback moment to the 2007 World Cup when he got 4 and 4. It almost felt like he was going to dismiss and run through the England middle order, which is one of the hardest things to do these days. Just for those who've not been following and keeping track of Malinga, he's been doing this whole long distance voyage and coming back since the start of the IPL, really, because he was asked to play the domestic one day tournament, and then he used to go there, play that game, come back, play for Mumbai Indians, and then get back. He's been doing it for almost 3 months now, which is crazy. But I'll ask you to even go further back and talk about the time you watched him play, and you did write about him in the Cricket Monthly about something along the lines of the last days of Lasith Malinga. What's been happening since he's come back from the wilderness pretty much within 12 months now? He's just kind of come back from nowhere to be their leading light of the World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that his one day career certainly was probably over at that stage when I was watching him, because the injuries had got to such a stage where he'd come back, have a few matches, and then some niggle would come up again. Thankfully, the injuries have stayed away this time since his return. And I don't know how he's managing it, but there hasn't been even a whisper of injuries. And I think he keeps his work rate pretty low in between matches. So he's, you know, he gets himself fit enough just to play a match. And then that's what Rangan Herath used to do as well. Very, very few overs in the nets in between games. And so he's been managing that side of things. I think like the incredible thing about him also is that he still clearly has a lot of fire, a lot of hunger to do something for Sri Lanka, even in this very average team. I mean, this is the worst team he's ever played for in a Sri Lanka shirt. But he's still got a lot of, a lot of hunger to do something for them. It'd be very easy for him, a player who's done almost everything in cricket, to just have walked away and said, I don't need this in my life. He could play another year of IPL, play the CPL, do the franchise circuit. It would have been a very easy thing for him to do, but he's decided that he's, even when Sri Lanka were not picking him, when he was on the outer with the selectors, when he was having fights with the board, fights with the sports minister, issues with other captains, he could have said I had none of it, but I while I was writing that story for Cricket Monthly, he was turning up virtually every day to Kettarama, where the Sri Lankan Cricket Academy is, and making sure that he was seen by coaches, bowling a few overs, just sort of insisting to them that he wasn't going away, that he was still here, that he was still available to be picked,
and that, he lost his contract,
they should be picking him. No, he never lost a contract, I think. He'd been bumped down, certainly, down the contract list. But he was, basically he was on the outer for about 8 or 9 months. And, the contracts hadn't come up during the 8 or 9 months. And by the time they came up again, he was back in contention. I just want to touch on another thing as well from the Sri Lankan game. I saw an amazing stat that of all the bowlers who bowled in that game, including Wood and Archer and all the England bowlers, Malinga swung the ball almost twice as much as any other bowler. And that's incredible for someone with his action, which, you know, any swing bowling coach will tell you that is absolutely not the way to bowl if you're looking to swing the ball. And that's, I guess, where he sets himself apart, is that he's got all the skills. He's got, you know, everything that you need to do with the ball. He's got that in his armory, and he can pull it out at the right time. And the ball to Vince that got Vince, and the ball that got Bairstow, were both swinging deliveries. They swung in different ways and got their wickets in different fashion. And I think that's he's at that level where he can turn up at a game and just be masterful. And that's what we saw.
Not sure you saw the whole thing on Twitter. It was on air, actually. Nasir Hussain said every time Malinga does well, his action comes into question on social media, and Holding responded to that by saying that that's why I'm not on social media. Basically, two former cricketers, former one captain and another fast bowler, agreeing that there's absolutely nothing wrong with his action. But the swing stat, you know, it says a lot about the kind of bowler, the kind of unique talent that he is.
Yeah, absolutely. I did hear that from Holding. Holding's had some great lines during the World Cup, actually. But yeah, I mean, I think there's actually never been a serious issue about his action. I mean, compared to, say, a Murali, I think everyone understands that Malinga's action is legal. It just looks awkward and it looks wrong, but there's never been a serious issue over it. And he gets that same hyperextension in the elbow that I think the likes of Bumrah and Shoaib Akhtar get, which is obviously a big boon to someone who bowls like that.
Yeah, talking of stats, Alan, the one other stat that I did notice was the fact that the Headingley wicket was among the slowest used in the tournament at this point. I think it was Ben Jones of Cricwiz who had tweeted that out. Is it still a problem for England if a pitch like this kind of turns up at a really crucial point? There's already some talk about the final being at Lord's, which is not really been the highest scoring of grounds in terms of the standards that they've set over the last 4 years. Does that still remain a worry against this team? Because we've seen an Imran Tahir used up top, and generally spin seems to be the way to go most of the time against these batsmen.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the immediate sort of touchstone game when talking about England coming unstuck on a slow surface is that Champions Trophy semi-final from a couple of years ago when, Pakistan bowled very well at Cardiff, where they'd played, I think, Sri Lanka actually in a bizarre game a few days before, but they sort of got the measure of the pitch and it slowed down. I think there was reverse swing played a part, and England yet struggled their way to about 230-ish, I guess, similar low score. Ben Stokes desperately trying to get away towards the end, and it didn't look enough. And then Fakhar Zaman came out and smashed it about a bit, and it clearly wasn't enough. And Pakistan obviously rode off into the final and then off with a trophy as well. But England have shown some signs of adapting to that. I mean, they have won in places where you think that the strengths are negated somewhat. You know, they've won on tour in Sri Lanka. They won 4-1 there
India,
before.
At home last year.
Beat India last year at home and at Headingley, where they held India to, I think, 250. I was looking at the scorecard, 256 or something for eight. And then England chased that down, two down. Joe Root finishing it with his bat drop, I think, a back-to-back 100. So, you know, there were, even at the start of the tournament when England played South Africa and only, I didn't say only, but scored 300. And there was a feeling that, well, you know, they'd had to adjust a bit there. And was it enough? They weren't quite sure. Stokes, again, had sort of batted nicely, but not as fluently as we have seen. And then that turned out that that was actually a very good score. They'd adapted very well. And they beat South Africa by 100 runs there. So, I mean, I think they will say they've made strides. Morgan, when talking about it, when asked specifically about kind of slow pitches and Cardiff afterwards, kind of just blanked it. And I mean, I think that's a tactic that he tends to do. Talking about the final being at Lord's, and yeah, Lord's certainly isn't the quickest, bounciest, most sort of run filled strip in the country these days. Two years ago, again, just before the Champions Trophy, England were reduced to 20 for 6 there against
Rabada.
exactly, by Rabada. I mean, that was a pitch that was more, I suppose, a bit green and seemed a bit, but yeah, it certainly didn't play to England's strengths. They kind of cobbled together 150 or something. I think Johnny Bairstow made a few, but yeah, they lost that game, obviously. And there have been these periodic implosions, not necessarily all in the same types of condition. I mean, there was one in Sri Lanka right at the end of the tour when they were chasing about 300 and they didn't get anywhere near. In the West Indies, when they were held to a 2-2 draw before the World Cup, in St. Lucia towards the end, when there was actually a bit of extra bounce more than anything. They were bowled out for 120 and the Windies blitzed that chase very easily. So I mean, it's really when it's not flat, England's weaknesses do become apparent. And whilst you'd have to say they've got players and they've got plenty of experience in players like Morgan and Root, who ought to be able to adapt, you know, clearly as Headingley showed, and perhaps it's because it's a World Cup and they're the home nation and there's that extra pressure, they are still a bit susceptible there.
Pirel, just concluding thoughts on this. I think you did write about missing the England that we're used to at World Cups. So going forward, it's pretty interesting that they run into the knockouts, which I'm assuming they will make it somehow or the other, includes games against Australia, India, and New Zealand. That's pretty much the rest of the top four as things stand. Where do you see this going? And once you do that, we'll get to New Zealand and whether they are going to be the underdog going into the last four if things stay this way.
Yeah, I mean, rooting for New Zealand's kind of a no-brainer now. They are playing the most interesting brand of cricket. I mean, interesting that you brought up pitches and England. And I think New Zealand are the team that have read pitches at global tournaments the best, you know, historically. They've always come to different venues, up against different opposition and adapted to them. And I saw a stat the other day that the New Zealand had the second highest number of World Cup wins and across, you know, all World Cups. And this is a team that's only once made it to a World Cup final and never won the tournament. So that's something impressive. And I think this New Zealand team, under Mike Hessen, we saw them do that, and under Gary Stead now as well, we're seeing them adapt to whatever situation comes up against them. And they're a team that's used to thinking on their feet. And they play a fun brand of cricket, you know, like Ross Taylor and Kane Williamson are great fun to watch. Lockie Ferguson's terrific as well. I really like Mitchell Santner. If for a neutral, if you're not from any of those countries, are an absolute no-brainer to support now. In terms of England, whether they'll get to, I think that era is over. Honestly, it was slightly comical the way they lost to Sri Lanka, but it'll never be the same as that completely inept completely out of touch England that we used to know and love. Because I remember, you know, in that piece, I make reference to the time when they got to 220 odd in Colombo and they thought they had enough runs, and Dilshan and Taranga came out and knocked them off in like,
for no loss.
For no loss. And at one point, Graham Swan was bowling. Dilshan cracked him through the covers or through cover point for four. And he looked really sheepish. It was almost like a four that he hit by accident, because Taranga still hadn't got to his 100 and there were only so many runs left before Sri Lanka won the game. So he wanted to, and then he did these like very, very, theatrical blocks for the next three balls of Swan, just to show his partner that no, he really wanted him to get to 100. And this is at a World Cup quarterfinal, and like those kinds of things, you know, it will, as they could lose the next three games, but like, you can't imagine those kinds of things happening to this present England team. So I think we're past that. We're past that era. Unfortunately, there. though it would be interesting if they lose on Tuesday or whenever it is against Australia. That will really make that race to the top four interesting, because I get the feeling that although we've seen these exciting games of the last few days, we'll still end up with the same semi-finalists that we always thought we were going to get from very early on in this tournament. And England are probably the only one who have a realistic chance of not making it, because, as you mentioned, they have those tough three teams to play.
They've got to step up and become the official LOLs supplier for the rest of us and the rest of the tournament. Alan, interesting that Phil brought it up, because I was thinking the same as well, in that we've seen a great weekend, a great extended weekend of cricket at the World Cup after asking for so long for some competition, some last over finishes, because it's been 4 days of some great action. And despite that, there's hardly been any movement in the top four. There is, of course, the rain factor that we spoke about in the previous episode, where teams have gotten 1 point instead of two. Nobody goes home with the full points in their kitty. And all of that stuff has contributed to where we are. But it is kind of frustrating, and we are now dependent on England to give us some entertainment in these last three games so that there is some shake-up here or there in terms of other teams having a shot at getting into the semi-final. How frustrating is the whole thing?
Yes, I mean, certainly the weather was frustrating in that sort of first fortnight. And I mean, I won't rule out England doing anything silly from this point onwards. I mean, yeah, the farcical possibilities are endless. I was reminded actually the other day of, I think I tweeted it, kind of like the 2011 World Cup. Basically all the entertaining bits were England, and I would include the Sri Lanka quarterfinal in that, because it's, as you know, Fidel would rightly pay a tribute to it, a comedic masterpiece. But you know, the tie with India, losing to Ireland,
the South Africa low scorer as well, which
exactly, managing to beat South Africa somehow. Not very convincingly beating the Netherlands either. So, I mean, it's not been quite that bad this time around, but losing to Pakistan and losing to Sri Lanka are probably the two most interesting results, of this tournament so far. The problem for the shake-up in the semi-finals, is that this format does, whilst theoretically could be great in that, you know, all the games matter and they're all really competitive with all the top teams in the world, also, it allows the top four teams to just sort of steamroll their way. And you had that for the first, so apart from England losing to Pakistan, the first 3 weeks of the tournament up until Friday, all of those teams won the games that you'd expect them to win. You know, Australia came a bit close against West Indies. New Zealand, India would have been a good game if it hadn't rained. But otherwise, you know, there was not really a whiff of an upset. And so those teams have banked a lot of points. And now, yeah, England have stored up a bit of trouble for themselves because they have New Zealand, Australia and India to play. Looking at the permutations, and I think you guys have done a piece on the site actually as well. I mean, England could win one of those probably and be fairly confident of going through. You would think that they probably will win one of those, given that they're the home team and their records against all three are pretty good in the last couple of years. But then again, you know, this is a World Cup and there is that extra pressure on them. I mean, it would be good, certainly, if losing to Australia on Tuesday would increase that a notch, and it would give a bit of encouragement to the likes of certainly Bangladesh and Pakistan. If certainly Pakistan beat South Africa today, that's still, you know, up for grabs, obviously. But Yeah, there's still quite a lot required to make it, you know, to bring in that potential for someone to gatecrash the top four. Otherwise, yeah, it's despite this interesting sort of 2-3 day period, it's going to be as you were come the sort of end of first week of July.
Right. So the last piece of the puzzle that we need to unpack is the game in Manchester, which Alan, I think you were supposed to be at, and unfortunately due to some last minute reasons you couldn't be at. Did you actually catch the game? What did you think of the whole thing? Because I switched off the TV when I think it was Gale. Yeah, when Gale hold out is when I switched off the TV and moved on. And then I wake up in the morning and see all these headlines and notifications. It was a big shock to me, and I was just gutted that I missed out the game completely.
Yes, you should have hung in there. This World Cup has been serving up thrillers. What possibly convince you to switch off? Unfortunately, I was supposed to be there. I was very much looking forward to a trip to Old Trafford. And then, yeah, a bit of family issues, had to come home and look after my little son. And so I didn't actually get back to London until kind of the game had started. And I sort of followed New Zealand's innings a little bit. Saw Williamson doing his thing. And then I only switched on. I did the opposite of you pretty much, Srinath. I switched on late in the evening once Wilfred had gone to bed and I was freed up from dad duties. So, I sat down with a beer and thought, oh, I'll just watch the end of this. Looks pretty much like New Zealand have wrapped this one up. I think Roach and Brathwaite were batting at the time, and I was also because I hadn't been able to go, and that left Sid Monger at the game on his own. I was kind of hoping he would get a straightforward game to cover. I was thinking, well, this looks pretty. You know, West Indies aren't going to chase this. Good story there. Williamson scored his 100. Chris Gayle scored a few runs. Monger will be fine with that. And then they got a bit closer, and then Roach got out, and then they put on a few more, and then Cottrell got out. And I'd actually sort of, I'd not followed where Evan Lewis had batted, and I thought he'd actually wasn't going to bat because of he torn his hamstring or whatever. I'd seen him up on, with his feet up on the balcony as if he wasn't intending coming out at all. And, so I thought Cottrell was the last wicket actually. And then I messaged Monger to say, oh, phew, there you go. That was a straightforward one. And then, obviously, Shane Thomas came out, and I was like, oh, no, Lewis did come out briefly. So still one more wicket to get, but they still need 40, 50, whatever. And Mong was like, oh, don't worry about it, it's fine. this is the no contest. And then, yeah, suddenly it all went Kolkata 2016, a game which I was doing. I did the comms for that, actually, on the final over. So, yeah, remember Carlos Brathwaite causing carnage fairly well. And yeah, poor Matt Henry didn't know where to bowl at the end there. Brathwaite having, I mean, it was actually superbly calculated. Yeah, cold, just working out. I'm going to get through Ferguson and Bolt, who Williamson had sort of bowled out in order to get that wicket. And then he had three overs left, which probably would have been Henry, Neesham, Henry again if he had to. But then Brathwaite took apart Henry, who'd had a tough early part of the game, I think, which I hadn't seen, but obviously been smashed around in the warm-up by the Windies as well. And you just sort of could feel his anguish, you know, see him disintegrating as Brathwaite sliced. I mean, they weren't all the cleanest connects. It wasn't quite like Eden Gardens, where he was belting certainly three of the four straight over long on or long off.
Some of the boundaries also might have been longer. I think the leg side, especially in the last over, might have been longer than anything at the Eden Gardens, probably.
Well, I mean, the final one that he got out to, yeah, that was quite a long part of the ground. I think Neesham probably knew that. I mean, Monger, who did a superb job of riding it up, I recommend the piece. All on Brathwaite in that last sort of two overs, sort of until the point when he finally picked out Trent Bolt. And you know, who else would you want under that catch? Albeit, I think Bolt had dropped a couple earlier in the game. So, a superb ending, and another iconic picture, you know, Brathwaite on his Steeler knees. Yeah, exactly. A Kiwi offering in a hand, and Ian Bishop on commentary. So, it was the perfect result, I suppose, would have been with the Windies to win it one wicket down. But it was still a cracking game. And I wish I was there for it.
Yeah, I wish you were there too. And I wish I was awake to watch it. just closing thoughts, Viral. New Zealand is sort of your second team in terms of your writing team you follow the most. You've written a number of pieces on them and the whole stereotype of what the nice guys that they are, etc. It was almost identical, the Ross Taylor picture that we just discussed. It's very similar to the Grant Elliott-Dale Steyn picture. It's kind of the second time in a World Cup where they're on the right side of a result like this. You do expect this stuck to type with that whole thing and what happened in the aftermath of that game. Talk us through a little bit more on this, because there's been reams and reams of stuff written on their nice guy image, but every time they make you, you know, go awe, maybe to say that, you know, we are these kinds of people and we don't do it just because you guys write about it or whatever. We are genuinely people like this, because I think it was Holder or Brathwaite, I don't know who said it, about New Zealand being genuinely nice guys, nice people to play cricket with. And lastly, do you see Sri Lanka kind of coming into the mix for the top four at some point? Because somebody has to do it. If let's say England, let's say, slip up, somebody has to take it.
Yeah, on the New Zealand nice guy thing, I think there was a time when it was very much a brand move, right? Like, so the way this whole thing started with New Zealand becoming nice guys, because there was a time when they weren't. I think I've written also in this, during this tournament, about the 2011 quarterfinal versus South Africa in Mirupur in Dhaka, where New Zealand just were completely nasty. I mean, they got stuck into Fafta Pussy, who just ran out AB de Villiers. They, like, Kyle Mills was coming on with his neon substitute vest and abusing du Plessis. The only time I've ever seen that in on a cricket field, that Stephen Fleming's team certainly weren't afraid of using their words, trying to intimidate the opposition in ways other than that weren't cricketing. I don't think it's fair to say that this is just like a national thing, you know, that they're all like this and this is just how they're built. I think there was one point when Brendan McCullum decided, to his great credit, that we're not going to play cricket like that and we're going to try and connect with our public, who probably were more receptive to a team that, you know, wasn't so outwardly belligerent, especially when they were losing. And then in the McCullum years, that shift happened. I think what we're seeing now, though, is like Kane Williamson, this is just who he is. What you see is what you get. Williamson has never been part of an angry reaction to anything, really. He's just super chilled out, just relaxed, and he typifies that New Zealand spirit that we've come to understand is now. And if you look through their fast bowlers, Matt Henry and Trent Bolt have never been someone who gives lip to the batsman. The only one in the New Zealand setup is Neil Wagner, who's not in the one day team, of course. So I think with this one day team, it is, they're just genuinely just being themselves, and they don't have to go out of the way to be nice. That's just what they're like. I think it helps that it's also their brand. So it sort of feeds off. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in a lot of ways. Sri Lanka, yeah, can they get to the semi-final? It's statistically possible. I think they have to win their last three games. I genuinely don't see them beating India. I think India might be a step too far, but they've got South Africa and West Indies next. And those are teams that they are capable of taking down, I think, especially this South Africa team that's probably hurting a bit from the World Cup that they've had. I'm kind of pessimistic. I don't think that they'll make it. I think they've already exceeded my expectations, certainly, that England win. I never thought that was going to happen. I think they've exceeded expectations for a lot of Sri Lankans who expected them to lose maybe in 8 or 9 matches on the trot, and they've managed to get at least a couple of decent results. The rain has helped them out a little bit as well. So maybe they go into those last three matches knowing that the pressure's off, knowing that they've already done something that no one was expecting them to, and then they play well. That wouldn't surprise me, but them beating India certainly would surprise me, and they probably need that win. They probably need 3 in a row to definitely get themselves a semi-final spot.
Yeah, how we wish somebody took the chance it's not Sri Lanka, somebody else like Pakistan, who are kind of known for these feats. As the World Cup rolls on and these underdog results from a crazy weekend carry on, may they last as long as possible till the end of the tournament. That's wishful thinking, but what's wrong in hoping at all? On that note, it's time to say goodbye to Alan. Alan, thanks a lot. Did you enjoy your debut?
Cheers. I felt very much part of the team. It was an honour. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Alan. And thanks, Fidel, as always. Good fun. Cheers.
Pleasure. Thanks. See you.
And that brings us to the end of yet another episode of Talking World Cup. We hope you had fun listening to it as much as we had fun bringing it to you. Remember to leave us a rating on iTunes. It helps more and more people find our podcast, as they have been over the last few weeks. And you can obviously get it on any other podcasting platform where you listen to podcasts, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else. Until next time then, from all of us at ESPN Cricket Info, this is Srinath Sripad signing off. See ya.